On this episode of This Week in Space, it's time to talk about life support in the great beyond with Grant Anderson of Paragon. Stay with us.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 86, recorded on November 3rd, 2023. Home is where the air is. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Bitwarden. Get the open source password manager that can help you stay safe online. Get started with a free Teams or Enterprise plan trial, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Space, the Life Support Edition. Whether or not you think Tarek and I deserve to survive our first trip into space, which is sure to come along any day now, we'll need lots of hot air for us to breathe. Speaking of Tarek the Terrible, how are you, my indocile friend?
The Terrible. Wow. Well, I'm counting the days to that first space flight. So if anyone's looking, you know, if they got an extra seat, I got a lot of frequent flyer miles. Can I use those, Rod?
Well, I hope you can count really high because truly nobody cares about us, but that's okay. Speaking of people that probably shouldn't care about us, this week our guest is the towering Grant Anderson.
Hello.
Of Paragon Space Development. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing great.
So, Grant, every time I see you at a conference, which I just did last week, I get a crick in my neck looking up. Just for the record, how tall are you?
In my prime, I was 6'4", but I ruptured a disc during the International Space University in 91, so I'm now 6'3" 3/8".
What were you doing at ISU that would rupture a disc?
Playing indoor soccer against a very talented Canadian that faked me out, and I tried to change three directions at once, and my back only knew two.
So. Oh, ow. Spoken like a true engineer.
I was going to go for, like, spinning in the centrifuge at, like, you know,
I know. I was going to go for something like heroic.
Yeah, I'll have to come up with a better story.
All right. Well, speaking of what isn't a better story, I have a space joke from Ken Johnson. Are you ready, Mr. Malik?
I am ready. Lay it on me, Rod. Lay it on me, Ken.
So why did the astronaut break up with their life support system?
Oh, wow. On point for today. Why? I don't know.
Because it was too controlling and wouldn't give them any space. You know, you don't have a lot of options when it comes to life support jokes. So
I thought that it was going to be because it was sucking all the air out of the room. So
that's a good. See that I can.
Do too. If you want me to have a life support system, throw somebody into space, I can arrange for that.
See, only if we get video. We get three drives. All right, moving along. As always, we invite you to join Tarek Silly Squad and send us your best or worst space joke, of course. And don't forget to do us a solid and make sure to like, subscribe, and other podcast goodness to us because, frankly, we need your support. And it's what we live for because Tarek and I just have small lives. So let's move on to some headlines so we can get to the good stuff and
yes,
talk to Grant.
I'll be fast this time, Rod. I'll be fast today.
So from space.com, we're coming up on solar maximum and it's going to get ugly, huh?
Yeah. Well, not ugly. I guess it depends on your perspective, but it's going to happen faster and it's going to happen stronger than we suspect. And we should probably start by saying what is solar maximum.
Yes.
And solar maximum is the time when the sun during its weather cycle, because the sun has one, is at its most active. And of course, this I think you mentioned it came from space.com, but the original source is from the Space Weather Prediction Group. We have one in the United States. NOAA runs it. And they ran some new experimental forecasts about the activity of the sun. And they found that the peak of its current weather cycle, solar cycle 25, is actually going to occur between October and 2024 and like January, basically a year earlier than planned. And they had estimated that it was going to be in the 2025, 2026 timeframe back in 2019. And what does that mean? It means that that's when the sun is going to be kicking off big flares, you know, some possibly dangerous ones for spacecraft or astronauts who are out in space on missions doing things. What else is happening? NASA wants to land on the moon with astronauts around that time frame too. They're going to have to be watching these weather forecasts really, really carefully to make sure that their astronauts are shielded. So these are really important forecasts, and having a more refined and better expectation of when this peak in activity could be would be really important for all of those missions. The technology like GPS communications that we rely on use satellite assets in space. And of course, if you are a sky watcher, they can amplify the auroras, which I've never seen in person, but I mean, they can really make them visible all the way down to here, you know, to New Jersey, even if not beyond. So,
and perhaps more excitingly, if you're watching the video version of this podcast, Tarek was just putting a polka dot over the story, which must be a new thing in the TriCaster. So that was pretty exciting. All right. Also from space.com, although I picked it up from Live Science, one of my favorite clickbaity titles of the year, rare space explosion could leave Earth uninhabitable for thousands of years, which translates as kilonova or killer neutron star novas are not our friends. Tell us your story, Mr. Clickbait.
That's right. Well, kilonova or killer nova. Kilonovas are like these massive explosions. I mean, they're so much more powerful than a supernova. They're the explosion of neutron stars out in deep space. And there was a new study that would calculate what would happen if one of these massive explosions occurred in the relative near vicinity of Earth. And relative is the key term, because they're looking at like 36 light years. The nearest star is 4 light years away. And this is, you know, 8 times farther than that. And what they found was, if one of those happened, you know, because it explodes like a sphere, I mean, the fallout would wash over our solar system, our planet, and it would render our planet pretty bleak, you know, over time. Now, the scientists did tell us at space.com not to worry about it, you know, just like, you know, getting hit by space debris, when you're walking down the street. It's very remote because space is big, but still, you kind of want to know what this stuff happens. And I think we were talking in our last episode about scary stuff in space, Rod.
Yeah.
Those things that are lurking out there that we have zero control over. This is one of those things. So,
well, but we do have some control, because if you ran really fast to the west, something like, what, 17,000 miles per hour, you could outpace the killer neutron radiation.
And put the planet's mass between you and the radiation wave. Yeah, there is that, I suppose. So,
see, guys like Grant that have big flashy headquarters and expense accounts would be able to get in their personal jet and just start flying west, you know, like at warp speed, while the rest of us just sat here and turned into pizzas.
There was something false in that story, but it wasn't about the neutron stars. It was about
frying. Okay. Well, we'll get to that. All right. Next up, from our friends at Collect Space, Rob Perlman.
Yeah.
Astronaut Ken Mattingly, who launched to the moon on Apollo 16, sadly dies at 87. This happens with the space race crowd, but
I was going to ask you about your thoughts on this, because I unfortunately never had the pleasure of speaking or interviewing Ken Mattingly, or TK, I guess, as he was known to his friends. But it is he is one of those iconic astronauts who had an inspiring life story. You know, there's the whole story about how NASA thought he was going to get the measles because he had been exposed to the measles during the Apollo 13 mission. He was pulled from that flight and then still had to help his buddies by figuring out ways to keep the spacecraft alive and activated with the CM, the command module, when they were stricken on their flight to the moon. But I mean, that's kind of my extent of knowing about him and his life was through Apollo 13 and 16. And of course his two shuttle flights, but I'm just sad that these icons, you know, we are losing them at a fairly accelerated rate because everyone is getting older these days.
Including us.
Well, there's that too, but I don't like to think about that part either.
No, it's interesting. Well, it's sad really, but we used to have a conclave called Space Fest, where we'd go, and it was a combination autograph show and speaking. And Grant knows it because it was
in Tucson.
Yeah. And it was fun because besides an art show and a lot of talks, you were able to meet and shake hands with the astronauts because they were there. And it was a signature show for a lot of them. But it got to the point where there were so few that were either still with us or able to travel, because that's, of course, part of it as well, that I think it just lost its viability and it's no longer a thing. But what is marked about this, and then we'll move on to your last story. It's especially rewarding. It was always cool to talk to these guys. I never actually talked to Mattingly in any length, but it was always cool to talk to them and pick their brains and hear their experiences and try to keep yourself from asking, what's it like to walk on the moon? Because if you ask that question, you're sort of out the door. But the older they got, the more reflective and philosophical they became. And you really started hearing more. They weren't just retelling experiences anymore. They were framing them in the contents, in the context of a life well-lived and family and friends and legacy and all that. And it became interesting. Even Buzz moved that, has moved that way. So, enough of that. Give us your last quick bite.
Yeah, I just had like a really quick rapid fire just to let people know that.
Well, I see three more, but.
Well, there's it's just, that's why we're going to be fast. But a friend of the show and a scientist and a Pluto expert extraordinaire, Alan Stern, our friend, we just had him on recently, just launched to space this week on Virgin Galactic's Galactic 5 suborbital flight on Spaceship 2. He launched with Kelly Girardi, an engineer, kind of STEM advocate, and space industry kind of icon herself, doing a lot of science in space, along with just a paying passenger, Keti Pucci-Sisti, I think I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Maison Rouge, a French and Italian space enthusiast who paid for her ticket to go on the flight. And that was a big success for them. And Virgin Galactic is going to move on to their next flight, which I think is happening earlier in 2024. I heard they're going to just kind of stand down and just do maintenance on the ship. But then, you know, they've launched every month. Maybe they might launch again next month for a Christmas flight. And so that was actually yesterday as we're recording this on Thursday. And then also today, as we're recording this, NASA unveiled their first public view of the asteroid Bennu. And this actually is from the Smithsonian Museum of
Public
National
view
History.
Being pieces of it you're talking about?
No, like an actual sample from Bennu that NASA gave them, you know, as one of the sharing the things.
That would be a piece.
Yeah, I didn't have a photo to share, you know, before this, because it's still kind of, it was brand new.
Here,
as I was
let me find college. A pebble around here. Nobody.
But it looks like that. They have a model of the Atlas rocket that launched the OSIRIS-REx mission. They have a model of the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft. And then there's literally, I kid you not, it's like the size of a half dollar a container that has the actual bit of the asteroid inside it with some lights shining on it. It's very small, but it came from space. And now you can go see it at the Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. So, and just a final point, if you like SpaceX and you're counting numbers, tonight there's a Falcon 9 launch. It's the 18th launch. It's a record number for that Falcon 9 booster. And we'll see how it does, because Elon Musk originally wanted to launch 10 in a row, and maybe they could get up to 20, and now they're too shy of 20. This is like their 90 plus something flight for the year, which is also pretty crazy.
So you're talking about 20 reuses of the same booster.
Yeah, well, they wanted 10 reuses. Now they're at 18, and Elon has said maybe they could get to 100, but I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. It's why they're using these veterans on their Starlink flights themselves. So
I think these rockets are becoming more reliable than my Jaguar. Of course, that's not exactly a high bar to clear. All right, we will be back with Grant Anderson, the terrific, in just a moment. Don't go anywhere. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Bitwarden, the only open source cross-platform password manager that you can trust. Security Now's Steve Gibson has even switched over. With Bitwarden, all of the data in your vault is end-to-end encrypted, not just your passwords. Bitwarden protects you by creating unique usernames and adding strong randomly generated passwords for each account. Plus, you can use any of their 6 integrated email alias services. You can log into Bitwarden and decrypt your vault after using SSO on a registered, trusted device. No master password is needed. This new solution makes it even easier for enterprise users to stay safe and secure with Bitwarden. You can also transparently view all of Bitwarden's code available on GitHub. On top of being public to the world, Bitwarden also has professional third-party audits performed yearly, and the results get published on their website. Share private data securely with coworkers across departments or the entire company with fully customizable and adaptive plans. Bitwarden's Teams organization option is just $3 per month per user, while their enterprise organization plan is just $5 per month per user. Individuals get Bitwarden's basic free account with unlimited passwords, now including hardware security keys or passkeys as a form of two-factor authentication. Get a premium account for less than $1 per month, or bring the whole family with their family organization option to give up to 6 users premium features for only $3.33 per month. Bitwarden's 2024 developer survey polled more than 600 developers to understand how they perceive and implement security best practice. This poll revealed 60% of developers manage 100 plus secrets, 65% practice hard coding secrets in source code, and 55% keep secrets in clear text prevail. 30% of sensitive data in generative AI platforms potentially risks involving developer secrets, 24% risk privileged credentials, and 28% risk customer information and more. 91% of developers undergo security training annually, yet over a fifth engage in risky behavior, such as using public computers to access work data and networks. At Twit, we're fans of password managers. Get started with Bitwarden's free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. So, Grant Anderson, thanks for joining us. Tell me about the what Paragon does and why you've made this essentially your life's work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Paragon does life support in extreme environments. So we're often, of course, space is even in our name here, so we're often associated with space. But in reality, we do any extreme environment. It just happens to be space is the ultimate extreme environment, so it's the majority of our work. But we also do ground-based things, mine refuge systems, contaminated water diving, anything where the environment is not going to just kill you, but kill you quickly. We protect the human body from that and also make sure that everybody's comfortable. Right temperature, has the right air breathe, all the different things are cleaned out of the air, and we actually get into the human factor side of it too. Make sure that it makes sense that something is in this position where you can reach it or you can't and stuff. So everything having to do with the human interaction with the environment that they're enclosed in, which is then protecting them from the really bad environment outside of them. As to why, well, there's a bunch of reasons. I came out of college and I worked for Lockheed in Sunnyvale, California for a few years, 10 of them, as a matter of fact. And,
have to say, you came out of Stanford University.
Okay. I came out of Stanford University with two degrees. And yes, I chose Stanford for the master's degree in aeronautics and astronautics. I'm the black sheep of the family. All my siblings are liberal arts majors, and I'm an engineer. So, but anyway, I worked for Lockheed, and after doing a stint on classified programs, which was very eye-opening to me, I went over to the space station program, and actually I worked my way up to be the chief design engineer for the solar rays, so the big blue and gold things you see on space station, which are now being, covered up by those other little small things that are being rolled in front of them. But I recognized a few things. One is that trying to do something entrepreneurial within a large corporate environment wasn't necessarily looked at as well. I went to the International Space University in 91, got to know some people, and started looking seriously in 92. I was trying to get Lockheed to get into the small satellite market. And if you've heard the Detroit, big cars, big profits, small cars, small profits, it was sort of the same attitude. Why would we do that? And I said, well, because you're going to lose the big market because you won't keep up with the technology with these things that take years to develop. And that's true. They're kind of out of some of the markets they were in then. So I met with some people, and one of the things that as an engineer, I'm a design engineer by trade, and designing around humans is really tough. It's challenging. It's fun. It's exciting. It's frustrating. And so consequently, we decided to start a company that we recognize that humans are going to space. No human's going to go to space without a life support system. So it's a perpetual market for the rest of eternity until we either bomb ourselves back into the Stone Age or turn ourselves into fully machined, Borgs. And so, that's what we did. And so I started with a biologist and a chemist. We were majority women owned, women in the leadership and the presidency and stuff. So we were actually women owned business first 22 years. And I mentioned that because that was the other thing. I felt there was a better way to run a company. The aerospace community back in the 1980s and 90s was fairly male centric. Let's say that with a fair amount of irony. It was almost all male centric. And so, just by opening a company that accommodated the needs for flexibility associated with everybody that works for you, treating people as a human and not a number. I still remember my Lockheed employee number, by the way. So that was all sort of the nexus of how we got going.
Can I ask just real quick, Grant, were you always hoping to get into space when you picked mechanical engineering, aeronautical, you know, engineering as focuses there, or was that like a happenstance, you know, as your path unfolded in the professional realm there?
Well, it evolved a little bit. I was an airplane nut. No question about it. I was the type that was, you know, sniffing glue, putting models together back when I was in elementary school and middle school. And then
that was good glue then too.
Yeah. And then I read Michael Collins' book on the space shuttle. And of course, back then that said it was going to turn around every week or two and fly and all that. So, yes, I definitely, like I said, chose, Stanford. They don't even have an undergraduate degree in aeronautics and astronautics. It's only a master's program. But I chose it for the master's program. And I actually did something called co-terminal where I crammed both my undergrad and my graduate into 5 years.
Wow.
So I definitely had that in mind, but I was an airplane nut, and that came from my first flight across the Atlantic, which was my fifth trip across the Atlantic. My first four were on ships, just so you know. I was a son of a diplomat. So I was on a 747 that had been flying about 11 months. And I remember walking up and down the aisles of that thing and looking out and seeing these big engines swinging in the breeze and everything else. And I was fascinated. And in fact, I was lucky enough to work on the startup of two airlines while I was in college. One of them was America West, and the other one was a company that didn't make it called Connect Air out of LA. But it evolved into the space side of it. But in the end of it all, it was using technology to further humans' capability to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. It just happened to be I started working off planet instead of, you know, from here to Singapore.
Well, so you started this company in 93, which was definitely before NewSpace and still kind of in that, I don't know how you'd characterize it, but from the peanut gallery, kind of a lull between the glory days of the shuttle, such as they were, and SpaceX kind of, you know, lighting a fire under all this. Was that in retrospect, was that the best time to do this? Or do you think you were a little before the gun?
Well, there's never the best time. It's always the time you grab, really. You know, back when you may remember in 93, the space station was supposed to launch in 96. Now it didn't launch till 99. But so there was this new thing called the space station. We recognized that you couldn't get the people who were doing the biological side of it and the people doing the aerospace side of it to talk to each other because they didn't have the same language. So we often joke for the first 10 years of our lives that we were the ones who were the translators between the people in Birkenstocks and lab coats and the people in pen protectors and horn rim glasses. And again, that gets back to this exciting nexus, you know, to be a Paragon engineer means you need to be a multidiscipline engineer. You have to know the biology. You have to understand the chemistry. You have to understand the mechanical engineering, more and more so the electrical engineering side of it, especially with the instrumentation we use nowadays. Mm. So there was that. So we recognized that the first goal, we always wanted to be a life support company, but the first goal was to be the designers of experiments that then would be on the station or on the shuttle. And in fact, in 1996, our first flight, we flew a biological payload on the STS-77, May of 1996. So
what didn't do too bad there. Mm-hmm. What was the experiment?
So we had invented something and patented something called the ABS, the Autonomous Biological System, and it was an enclosed aquatic environment that would stay stable. So if you were to go home and take a mayonnaise jar and put a bunch of biology in it and close the lid and put it on a shelf with a little bit of light, of course you need some energy, it turned into brown goo after a little while, or green goo. We patented a way to actually to limit the different life-giving chemicals, phosphorus, potassium, and a few other things so that it would stay stable and actually oscillate between the animal and the plant life in it. So the flight in 96 was just to prove out the concept, but then that led on to a flight 3 months later up to the Mir on what was known as NASA 3, and it got put on the Mir space station for 3 months and then brought back down And then we did that again a year later and did another 3-year mission. And really what it was to do is to see, A, if you could survive, if the animals could procreate. So Paragon's the first company to have animals procreate through multiple generations in space. So we proved that that was possible, which was not even known at that time. And then look at the different things. I mean, we had a whole biological journal dedicated to that first 3-month flight. It was published in Japan because we were working in conjunction with Japanese researchers. So we were starting out pioneering things from the beginning.
Wait, Tarek, hold on 1 second. Let me just get this straight. You guys are behind that cool thing I always wanted to buy but haven't, which is that little glass sphere with the snail and the leaf and the water in it.
Yes, we actually, that was a little deviation, and I use that very often in my talking to business schools about entrepreneurship and staying focused. But yes, you could buy a biosphere in your Christmas catalog. We're the biggest shipper of by weight by FedEx out of Tucson for a few years because we were loading up semi-trucks and sending them out to the world. You could buy that. In fact, I just had somebody call me and say, I found my biosphere and we've had this back and forth on it. And it was made in 1998. I could tell them exactly the date it was made back because the serial number was, had a bunch of information in it and it still had life in it. It was still producing gas and stuff. It just didn't have the higher order animals, but. Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm. Must have been some snail, Rod, to catch that you're still thinking about it, huh?
Yeah, well, you know.
I have a really quick story about the snails. Is we found the snails could walk on the outside, in other words, the water side of an air bubble in space. They could actually tread and walk around the bubble. Wow. We had video. One of the things we did, we were the first ones to put a PCR digital camera into a spacecraft, and we actually had it film snippets over the 3 months. It was really cool.
That Grant is what I wanted to ask about, because when the average reader or viewer or listener thinks about life support, they think about astronauts, right? They think about those Apollo astronauts like Ken Mattingly were talking earlier, or even earlier where they're just in a can and you think, you know, it's air, it's heat, it's water, maybe it's a spacesuit or whatnot. But you're talking about putting, you know, creatures in a tank. As life support, you know, fish in multiple generations in a tank in space without gravity, and how you got to deal with all of that stuff. And I'm curious, just out the outset, you know, it's 1993 and you're forming the company. How has that concept of what life support is either evolved or changed over like the last 20, 30 years, or even since like the dawn where it was just make sure that the person doesn't die, versus now, you know, that they're comfortable, that it's an experience, that they're selling tickets to go to the space station now, for the folks that can afford it. I'm just curious if you can kind of touch on that, because it seems like it's a changing thing from, you know, preservation to, I guess, enjoyment and comfort. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a little bit like you go on a, you know, the first safari destinations that opened in Africa. It was pretty still, you know, if you see the pictures from the 1930s, you know, it was a pretty rough living, right? Or some of the things like you saw Teddy Roosevelt do in the early beginning of the century. And now you go to a Maraval resort on a safari and it's got everything. So everything sort of creeps towards better and better comfort, more amenities and what's going on. We've definitely seen that in our industry. I have kind of a, when I'm meeting astronauts in that space fest, that Rod mentioned in the beginning was one of them. Well, I always used to chide him the fact that the commercial people were giving us larger temperature ranges for what's acceptable than the astronauts. So I always said the astronauts were wimps compared to the tourists. But yeah, it really comes down to, putting a human in space is very expensive and they've got to be productive right away. So the more, less adaption they have, the more they have to worry about their environment and go twiddle this knob and that knob versus actually getting down to the work is a lot of money. So it makes sense to make them better, but it's just also evolution. You know, I'm sorry, but a 19 or a 2023 Lexus is nicer than a Model T. You know, you're going to start out basic and then work up.
Seat right, control, well, seat temperature controls. That's what I want in my spaceship, right?
Yeah. So. I want a heated steering wheel. Okay, we will be back in just moments after this break, so don't go away. So Grant, being the village elder in the room by some years, I grew up during the space race, and I remember being amazed not just that you could send astronauts to the moon. Well, it was kind of amazing you could do it as close as every 10 weeks. It's hard to imagine now. But you could send astronauts to the moon for around a week or a little more with enough life support to keep them alive in that little tiny Apollo capsule, 280 cubic feet or whatever it was. And then to see the backpack on those guys that could last in later flights anyway, up to, I don't know, 8 hours, 9 hours, the PLIS pack, personal life support system, or portable life support system, depending on where you look, was just mind-bending. And now I see a headline, sort of a cute headline on your website, says NASA just recycled 98% of all astronaut pee and sweat on the ISS, which in itself isn't that appetizing, but pretty astonishing. And I think this gives nuclear subs a run for their money, which, I mean, they're just in the water. You know, they have gravity. They have a nuclear power plant. They have all this stuff that you can't have on something like the ISS. So this is apparently a very big achievement. Yeah.
Yeah, and it is a paragon achievement working in conjunction with NASA, of course. We have we call that the BPA, the brine processor assembly up on station that achieved that. And it was the first of 10 technical goals that NASA has made towards going towards Mars. And a little bit back to Tarek's question about what's gone different and what's evolved. Things go very slowly in space. As you know, NASA's slow to adopt things. And frankly, back on the Mercury and Gemini and Apollo days, the life support system was sort of a side business for the big corporations that were doing things. You know, Garrett was the big one, which now Honeywell for doing a lot of stuff. Frankly, there weren't a lot of new technologies. That water technology is a brand new technology, existed in a different form on Earth, but we adapted that. And over the space of multiple small business innovative research and different research and then development contracts, went and flew that up to the space station in February 21. So it's been up there. It's gone through. It saved more water now and the weight of the water to launch than it cost NASA to build. Wow. And it's continually saving it. Every time we have a continuous, the consumable part of that is kind of a bladder that is selective to water. So you put the urine inside and nothing but water comes out of the other side of the bladder of the membrane, so to speak. And then we desiccate it. Literally, you end up with a bag of salt at the end of it all, and that gets thrown away. How we measure how good it is the amount of weight you have to throw away versus what you recover in water. And that one runs, because of the way it's operated, at about 20 to 1, as far as actually 40 to 1, about half a kilogram of throw away for every 40 kilogram, every 20 kilograms of water.
That is crazy. Wow.
Yeah, that we can actually, we're in the middle right now of a development project to get up to 100 to 1.
Wow.
But that was one of the first. Another one was the CTS-100, Boeing's vehicle, has our new humidity control system on it, as will HALO, the one that Northrop Grumman is building, which we're building the life supports for. And that has a membrane technology that removes the water from the air and in both cases throws it overboard because it's not a long-used vehicle. And that was the first new humidity control technology flown in 40 years, 50 years. So things happen slowly. I'm proud to say Paragon's been at the forefront of most of those new things going on in space, because we're focused. We just do life support, and it's not just a side business to us. So we're always innovating. And in fact, if you want to say something interesting about Paragon, is that we've systemized how to innovate. So that, you know, we do fixed price development programs. We know how to do it on a budget. And the Boeing one was a perfect example. That was a fixed price development program to make the brand new humidity control system for them.
Well, just so people realize, because you start talking about saving water and you think, oh, that's nice, you're saving water. But if I got my math right, the average astronaut's weight or mass is probably about equivalent to 20 gallons of water, right?
20 times 8, 160. Pounds. Yeah, for a 190-pound astronaut, that's about right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, between the cost of launching that and the amount of space it takes up and the fact that you could launch another human being up there for that, recovering water becomes increasingly essential. And then when you talk about going out to Mars, it's huge. I mean, you may have a lot of water, you know, acting as a jacket around radiation and so forth, but nonetheless, it's going to be a critical resource. I mean, you're talking about being stuck in a can for 7 months. the more you can recycle, the better. So kudos to you guys.
Yeah, that's why one of the reasons we concentrate on that first, and we're working on all the others.
Astronaut Don Pettit would always say that those technologies are always turning yesterday's coffee into tomorrow's coffee, is what he likes to say. When they first started drinking their own recycled water on the station. I did want to ask, though, because it's really hard for me to picture, Grant, how do you recycle sweat? How do you even get the sweat? Like, do they have to, astronauts have to like wipe themselves down with a towel and stick it in like a ringer or something like that? Or does it come like right out of like the air? I mean, how do you do that? Like my gym has this thing that when you go swimming, you can put your towels in like a spinner thing and it'll suck all the water out by spinning it really fast. Is it like that?
Yeah. In general, with sweat, you let it go into the atmosphere. You know, most of it evaporates, does its job, right? And cool you off. And that it does that by evaporating off of your skin. That goes in and raises the humidity of the air. But we try to keep the humidity of the air between 40 and 70% relative humidity. So you go through a condensing heat exchanger. So the heat exchange is cold enough. So you get water condensing, just like on a cold beer glass in the middle of Florida. Mm-hmm. And then that gets, right now sucked off of the, in something called a slurper bar down into a separator. And then they separate that, put it in the water. Paragon actually has just debuted a new technology called Cosmic, which actually uses a different way to suck that water out of the air. That's actually one of our multiple innovations that we're working on. We have a suborbital flight program going on that'll fly next summer.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's like the dehumidifier in my basement, except you're not grossed out with what it takes out of your air in your basement at the end of the day.
You don't want to drink either of them because there's a lot of things that dissolve in the gases that dissolve into water. Ammonia does. It can dissolve into water. Some things don't, but a lot of things do. So you still have to, once you collect that water, you have to run it through what we call a polishing process to mm-hmm. clean it to something that's potable, that's drinkable.
Okay.
So I think this is all very cool, but the real news here is that Tarek goes to the gym. I'm kind of astonished. So kudos to you. So Grant, one of the things I'm dying to ask you is, you know, because Mars is so much in our minds, I mean, we want to get back to the moon first, but for some of us of a certain age, we kind of done the moon. And while Artemis is going to be a great program, you know, we're kind of waiting for that news of the next destination. What scares you the most about keeping people alive and well during a Mars journey? What would keep you up at night if there was a crew on its way?
Well, during the Mars journey, I divide into two parts, getting there and then being on the surface. Getting there, what probably scares me the most is a breakdown in the life support system that we haven't thought of. You know, it's not that whether something will break, it's when it will break. Right. So a lot of our time is spent figuring out what's the best way to back up. So you have to take a life support system and break it down into elements and then say, if this fails, you know, how long before you can't live? And so in some cases, like the pressure system fails, it's minutes. If the CO2 scrubbing thing fails, a little bit like they had the trouble on Apollo 13 that was mentioned before, you would maybe have a few hours. And other things like the water recycling system or other parts of the air revitalization, you might have days. So you have to look at each one of those, determine that is it better to have a dissimilar redundancy? In other words, a system that's different so that if it was a generic failure, that you don't have a generic failure on both systems, or whether it's a repair function and did you pack the right things to repair it? And so it's a logistics issue. And you have to trade all of those and figure out which one's the best. That's why we say, you know, we only do life support because I can tell you every single element of the life support system and where it falls in that criticality, meaning how fast will somebody die if it's not working versus mm-hmm. maintenance and repair time.
What about the computers that control those systems? You know, they're back in, what is it, 2007, there was a major computer crash on the International Space Station that, you know, prevented them from doing things like attitude control, you know, where mm-hmm. you're pointing away from the sun at the appropriate point, you know, so that you don't get cooked or whatever. Is that something that you have to factor in too? Because you've got the hardware for life support alone, and then that's part of an overall architecture for the spacecraft that runs all of that. So is that something you have to factor in? Like, could that fail and then it leads to a cascading failure for your own systems?
Yeah, definitely. So almost everything that we have that's critical that has an automatic control has a manual override. Mm-hmm. So that if the computer system that controlling it dies, you at least can control those critical things. Usually that's oxygen, pressurization, and some of the CO2, scrubbing systems. The good thing about life support though is nothing happens fast. You know, despite those scenes from Star Trek where everybody's dying and laying on the deck and then they fix the life support system, everybody jumps up and starts running around 30 seconds later. It doesn't happen that way. In fact, we don't get a lot into the computer control because normally what we do with our customers is we say, here's the algorithms to run our system. Put it in your subroutines in the software and then flight computer, because frankly, you can control a life support system in the downtime between all your other functions. You know, you have to check something every other second is way too fast, and which is in the, like I say, in the pause time between functions on most processors nowadays. So we haven't found that it's cost effective to come up with your quote unquote own little flight computer, because A, it's one more thing that can break. B, it's very expensive to build and qualify mm-hmm. when it can really be done with something that's already got triple redundancy in your flight system anyway. So very often we're writing the algorithms, passing to the software people that are sometimes internally, but sometimes at our customer. And then they're translating it into commands out of that system.
So we had Mike Hecht on here, oh gosh, probably a little over a year ago, who was the PI on the MOXIE project for the Perseverance rover to extract oxygen from the Martian atmosphere. And he said something which delighted me, which is, and I don't remember the exact quote, but basically, technology testing is doomed to succeed on Earth. So, you know, when you're talking about what sound like fairly complex systems and you are doomed to test it in a 1G environment, and now you've got to fly this stuff at 0G environments, I assume qualification is a huge and expensive part of what you do, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, as you probably know, Rob, we call that the valley of death, is that you can have all these different technologies up there to what's called a TRL, technology readiness level 5 or 6. But to get over the hump and get it to fly is very tough because it's very expensive. That's true. I mean, our techniques are one to make them like the membrane bladder technology. We could only test it in 1G. But all of our analysis said it'll actually work better in 0G because you have better flow around the thing. And it turned out that was true. So it takes a little bit of analysis. So, you know, working with these commercial space vendors, some of them are going to provide a module that doesn't have any microgravity. Other ones are going to have spinning ones that have a partial G. There's one little mathematically incorrect, but very true saying that 0.1 G is a lot closer to 1 G than 0 G. If you have any sort of differential in it, it helps. But yeah, I know, talking to NASA headquarters, Robin Gaydens there, she says 80% of all the failures in the life support system on the space station would never have been discovered on Earth because they all were related to 0 G problems. So there is a certain amount of, yeah, you can analyze and paralysis by analysis and never get it flying. But until you get it flying, you really don't know with 100% certainty it's going to work.
All right. Well, we'll be back with Tarek's next brilliant question and Grant's even more brilliant answer right after this break. Stay with us.
I feel a lot of stress now, right? After Rod hyped up the question for sure. But well, Grant, I actually wanted to build on what you were just saying about gravity just in particular, because, you know, again, there's like a traditional thought of what life support is. And then you were just talking about having an environment where you have some sort of gravity now in space where, you know, traditionally we think of it being, you know, totally, totally weightless. And I imagine that a rotating 1G environment is a form of life support for astronauts that might be on a ship like that. But we haven't had one yet. We've seen it in science fiction for like, you know, decades, but we don't have a giant ring station like in 2001 or whatnot. And I'm curious if in the research that you've been doing since 93, you've either found, you know, what the serious challenge is for that, or that it's actually really not a requirement for us to thrive in space or for any kind of, you know, higher life form that we want to send, you know, dogs or cats or farm animals. I don't know, you know, if you're going to have a colony in space. So,
yeah. I will say that I, the jury is still out on whether humans can survive and thrive for you know, what I would say tens of years or even years in a microgravity environment with almost no gravity, without no up or down. You know, we actually did an experiment with the University of Arizona, DeLuca Labs, on T-cell growth, because one of the problems astronauts have is their immune system crashes in space. The number of white blood cells goes down by about 90% or so. What we discovered is that from the precursor cell in the, that's made in the thymus tissue in your neck until it becomes a true T cell goes through about 16 steps. And your body's very careful about this because, of course, that cell can kill yourself. I mean, autoimmune diseases are really your white T cells attacking parts of your body. And we found that there were two of those steps that were probably orientation dependent, which, and the orientation was assisted by gravity. So we think what's happening is astronauts get up in space and you still end up with some T cells because randomly they'll be in the right orientation, but you don't have the extra bit added in that you have the gravity to help that situation. So that's only just one example. The human body is really complex. And in fact, I'm flying to LA tomorrow for a all day meeting on Sunday with space medical people about this. It is not a formal research program at Paragon because frankly, there's no near term money in it. I can only put my money towards things that pay off. But, the epigenetic response of a human being, and epigenetics is essentially your body's DNA system turns on and off things depending on the environment. What that does in the long term is a very big interest to me. You go to Mars. One of the bigger problems we have is what medical systems do you send with the astronauts? So a little bit of your question, Rod, there about, you know, what worries me on the way. And, you know, there's been all sorts of field studies in the overnight overwinters in Antarctica. What medically do you need to make it through? And even then they had a person that had to evacuate or operate on themselves down in the South Pole one time. But it's those things that what will the body do that they will express themselves that we don't even, it's not even a disease that exists in the United, on Earth, you know, what will happen there. So I'm a little worried about the human body. That's a little farther out. So I would always be more comfortable to have a gravity environment. You know, there's some arguments, again, with that, what's closer. I'd rather have a 1/6 gravity of the moon or a 3/8 gravity of Mars than none at all for a long duration on things. But the human body is complex and we don't know enough yet. The twin study was good. It did show that there were some epigenetic markers that changed and what they call methylation, which is part of the whole cellular structure thing. This is, again, you know, you were talking life support. You didn't know you were going to talk genetics and epigenetics. Yeah.
Well, you're smarter than you look, buddy.
That twin study was NASA astronauts Mark and Scott Kelly, identical twins. One went in space while the other stayed on the ground for a good chunk of a year. So
yeah, and it, you know, nothing like a data point of one to make Kroc do conclusions out of. I mean, you need a PhD to draw a curve through one data point, just so you know. So only smart people can figure out what happened there. But but we need more of that. We need. But astronauts famously don't like to be monitored, definitely don't like to be, you know, lab mice in experiments. So actually part of the meeting on Sunday was a little bit about that and how we're going to go about that.
So I know, when we have a large crew, you know, 10 people or so up at the space station, it stresses the life support system and atmospheric conditioning and all that. And I'm going to phrase this carefully because I don't want to jeopardize any current or possible future contracts you might have in mind. But so far, SpaceX has developed a life support system that works for the Dragon capsule, which is 3 to 4 people. We ask continually about Starship and we get a lot of smiles and shrugs. And it's like, yeah, we got that covered. Well, you know, for 3 or 4 people, albeit in a volume the size essentially equivalent to the space station, maybe they do, but he has talked in the past about maybe having 80 people on that thing for a Mars trip. That's a different project. So, I mean, do you attach a trailer to the side of it that carries this massive life support system and huge spare tanks of oxygen, or how does that work? I know this is kind of a simplistic question, but it's a real head scratcher for me.
You can always resupply and you know, send a trail of things behind. But let me get to the other end of the problem, literally, which is the waste. When Elon announced the Starship back in Guadalajara at IAC and said he was going to send 500 people or whatever in it, I got a call from a famous space reporter, just like you, Rod, and he said,
not quite.
And he said, Grant, what do you think about this? And I said, ask him where the bathrooms are. And he goes, well, he kind of laughed. And I said, no, that's my world, you know, and right now humans are batch processors. You know, we eat and then we, you know, poo and peep, if you want to say it, fecate and urinate is the technical term. And that's a batch, and you've got to be able to store that and then process it and recycle it or whatever else, but you've got to batch it. And by the way, when everybody wakes up in the morning, if you have a continuous, you know, day night cycle, that means everybody's going to pee at once. That's what stresses your sewer system around your house and in your town. And anyway, so then what, a year later, he was down at Adelaide at IAC and said it was going to be 100 people. And that same reporter called me up and all he said is his name. And I said, did you ask him where the bathrooms are yet? And he started laughing and it's 100 people. I was at the ISPCS, or the International Symposium on Personal Commercial Spaceflight. And somebody said, Grant, so how many people can go on a Starship to Mars? And I said, you know, I'm working with zero data here, but I'm opinionated anyway. But, you know, but looking at the size they have now and what I understand it has to do in the landing capabilities, so the tanks for that and everything else, I think it could hold about 7 or 8. And there was a little bit of an audible, you know, gasp from the audience on that. Purely a wild guess. Sorry. But a lot of people do underestimate, what it takes to support a human. It's out of mind. You know, you flush the John and it goes down and it's out of your house and you don't worry about it. There's a whole system that processes that's downstream from you. And so anyway, we don't get the respect. We get no respect. I tell you, we get no respect.
You must have been an awesome first date, because you're to look your partner in the eyes and say, you're the best looking batch processor I've ever spent time with. I mean, this is true engineering speak, you know? Okay, sorry, Tarek, go ahead.
I was just going to say that the bathroom is like just one system. And I was there in 2019 when Elon and SpaceX unveiled the first Starship, and it looked a lot smaller than what I thought was going to fit 100 people on it. And I asked specifically about life support and how they were going to scale it up. And it's like, well, we got it down. We got it down for Dragon, so I think it's going to be fine. And I was like, I don't think it's going to be that fine.
What year was that?
That was 2019.
2019. Yeah, it was interesting. I don't know if you know, but Paragon was there at the beginning of SpaceX, because what Elon wanted to do with his PayPal money was to put a greenhouse on Mars.
Yeah. Right.
And we had actually designed one for JPL for the 2001 lander that lost out budget-wise. And so we were designing that. We had actually contract with him, and we had a brass board working in our lab, and he went to try to figure out how to launch it and then got pissed at the launch industry and started SpaceX. So we were on that team from the beginning. We had continuous contracts with SpaceX in 2013. So the architecture of that life support system on Dragon is ours, as is, by the way, the architecture on the CTS-100. Mm-hmm. Every single human spaceflight vehicle that's been designed in the United States since 1999, Paragon has been involved with it one way or the other. Nice. System does, and I know what is recyclable and what's not. And that's a little bit of the, I remember it was again the ISPCS, and somebody from SpaceX was there and they were doing the cargo vehicle, and they said, well, what about when you put people on it? And the person literally said, to noticeable giggles in the audience, oh, what do you have to do with humans? Just add a little bit of oxygen. And you could tell of us in the live spirit, it was, I didn't giggle, but a lot of other people did. Like I say, we don't get respect. The human space flight program is a biology program with a little bit of rocket technology thrown in, and that you can maybe go, that's not what the emphasis is when you see the PR.
I like the way that description, you know,
and I like the fact, you know, how cool is it to be able to say every human space flight project in the United States since, what was it, 99?
Mm-hmm.
Carry some of your technology, and still I'm struck by the fact that you don't have a private jet. This is something that we have to address. So this is kind of a big gooey question, but in terms of critical technologies, what's changed since the ISS was designed in the mid to late 90s?
Well, for one thing, the miniaturization of electronics has been big, and the ability to monitor things has changed dramatically. Mm-hmm. Although we're still looking for an oxygen monitor that won't drift over time, and we think we've got one. We're actually building the oxygen monitors for the Halo vehicle. In the short, maybe not a lot. They've been refined. The new technologies, like the new humidity and stuff technology that we're putting on Halo, the configuration, it used to be that the life support system would try to shove all the air through the different things in order to clean out the different products. And what Paragon pioneered on this first CC Dev 1, we were the only company that was not a systems company that won a contract on that, is what we call selective bypass. Is there's, say you have to move 450 cubic feet of air every per hour in order to circulate the air, because you always have to circulate air because people drown in their own CO2 if you're not always washing it away from them. But what we did is we made selective bypass. So you only sent 30 cubic feet of that 450 through the CO2 scrubber, and you only sent 25 through the trace contaminant control system. And what that did is reduce the fan work so much. So you reduce the power and selectively, you only have to remove so much at some time. And it's a chemical thing, or usually of frankly, what concentration you can put through what thing that scrubs out that concentration at certain rates to get it out the other side like you like. So that's something that's pioneered. Doesn't sound real sexy. And in fact, one of the problems I have is people always want to come and film the space company here in Tucson. Right. And yeah, I said, well, this humming box here, and this box doesn't hum because we don't have a fan in it, and this box hums. You know, it's not real exciting looking hardware sometimes. Right. But to the knowledgeable person, it is. And they're always, what Paragon makes is always beautiful, I might add. But that's the design engineer in me talking to. Did I answer that question, or did I go off on a tangent?
No, you did. And okay. I mean, I've still got more. I want to talk about dust mediation. Yeah. I have a bunch of other things, but we're kind of running out of time here. Mm-hmm. So the important thing I need to ask is, when is your book coming out?
Well, funny enough, I haven't written a book. I've got titles for three different books that I would write once I maybe retire. There is a technical monograph that's in work. The first book came out in April. I don't make any money on this, so this is not a plug. But it's called Interstellar Flight, and it's done by Les Johnson and, bringing the other guy out of Glenn. And, anyway, I wrote the chapter on life support. So how to build a life support system that goes to the next star.
Wow.
And there's some things in there that will, I know, excite and also piss off some of the life support community. I'm not a big fan of the salads in space idea as far as that farms. I say in that chapter that the life support system, if it's biologically based, would look a lot more like a brewery and a lot less like a farm. Mm-hmm. You know, the use of biological systems to produce oxygen, to reduce CO2 and all that is fairly well known. But the efficiency sucks, if I may say it that way. That second book, I'm a chapter of the second book, and the last I heard it was going to come out in the end of the first quarter of next year. It was delayed a little bit, but I recommend people read that. And like I said, I don't make any money on it, so I'm not plugging something on your show here.
Not to worry, because I can tell you firsthand, the current marketplace, it's unlikely you'll make money on any book. So it doesn't matter whether it's that or another one. They're kind of all the same, unless you become an A-list bestseller for writing erotic space fiction or something. I want to thank – yes, Tarek, I went there. I want to thank everybody for
– I wasn't going to say anything.
Joining us today for our exploration of staying alive in deep space. Grant, where can we find you online preparing for your next journey to the great beyond?
Paragon is at www.paragonsdc.com for Space Development Corp. You can find us on all the social media channels on a variation of that, not TikTok, but everything else. And frankly, those are all Paragon things. I have a personal social media presence, but I try to make sure that that's separate and not that. I don't want to be the face of Paragon necessarily. Mm. You know, I want my company to go on beyond me. If I get hit by a bus tomorrow or live out my natural natural life. I don't want it to be that Paragon is in danger if I'm not here. So definitely go to the Paragon sites and you can follow us and find out all the things we're doing. And I got to admit, some of them we can't tell you, but they'll come out eventually.
Okay.
All right. Whoa. And Tarek, where are you crouching like a hidden tiger these days?
Yeah, well, I'm at space.com, as always, trying to figure out what the next big thing in space is going to be. Looking forward to the SpaceX launch this evening as we're recording this. And you can find me on the Twitters at Tarek J. Malik whenever I feel, I guess, inspired to do it. And if you play Fortnite.
Like, oh, here it comes.
it's a new season today, and I'm looking forward to diving into that this weekend for sure. So.
Okay, and of course, you can always find me when I'm not making fun of Tarek. You can find me at pilebooks.com and at astromagazine.com. Please don't forget to drop us a line at twis@twit.tv. That's twis@twit.tv. We welcome your feedback, good, bad, and indifferent. Well, indifference bad, but you can be
love us.
Pro show,
love us.
Or you can have criticism. We'll take it with grace and goodwill. We do read and respond to every email because we love you. Also, don't forget, check out space.com, the website's in the name, and the National Space Society at nss.org. Both are good places to satisfy your unquenchable spaceflight cravings. New episodes of this podcast publish every Friday on your favorite podcatcher, so make sure to subscribe, tell your friends, and oh, in case I didn't mention it before, give us 5 stars or a thumbs up, because we frankly... our egos are weak enough that we need that from you. Don't forget that you can get all the great programming on the Twit Network ad-free on Club Twit, as well as some extras that are only available there for just $7 per month. That's the cheapest mental life support you can get. You've heard Leo talk about the tough times facing podcasters. Everybody's having to cinch their belts a bit. We could really use your support, so please step up and be counted. Finally, you can follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter and on Facebook and twit.tv. on Instagram. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye, everyone.
It's midweek, and you really want to know even more about the world of technology. So you should check out Tech News Weekly, the show where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news.
It's the biggest news. We talk with the people writing the stories that you're probably reading. We also talk between ourselves about the stories that are getting us even more excited about tech news this week.
So if you're excited, well, then join us. Head to twit.tv/TNW to subscribe.